This is an I Am Listening podcast.
Inside the Conservative Party that would agree on any particular deal for years. And, you know, Craig and I were on, as it were, different sides of this argument, but it showed you can still remain friends, even if you have different views on Europe. But the point is, the Tory party was evidently presenting a disunited face to the public, with all the political consequences we've seen, but also the European side of the negotiations could see,
they could see the weakness,
that this was a weak government. And so we ended up spending 3 years trying to get a deal. Yeah, lost a prime minister in the process, had to do an emergency deal at the end of it, and the sort of British politics felt exhausted.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, in a week which takes us back to our dog-eared thesaurus in search of yet another synonym to describe the turbulence, upheaval, chaos or tumult in British politics. Thinking back, it seems not a week has gone by where there hasn't been some fiasco for the past, well, would you say about 10 years? It's apt then that this week we'll be taking a look at 10 years ago, to June 23rd, 2016, on the fateful day when Brits went to the polls and decided 52-48% in favour of leaving the European Union. A decision which, it's a bit of an understatement to say, had a fair few consequences for the country and its politics. Here to discuss the Brexit referendum and what it caused, even possibly up to today, are my fellow local democracy reporters, Simon Finlay, who covers KCC.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the county's district and boroughs.
Hello.
I'm Robert Boddy, who covers Medway Council. So let us begin by gazing back into the mists of time. Simon, what are your recollections of the referendum campaign?
Well, unlike you, I was actually in my 50s then. but looking back on it, there was a lot of anticipation about it. The campaigns were very divisive, and there was a lot of talk about the big number that was written on the side of the red bus, which was factually correct, but was factually incorrect at the same time. And that seemed to be, the whole Leave campaign was based on a lie, and the other side was dubbed as sort of Project Fear. Mm. So there was all that sort of going on at the same time. When the result came through, the Leave campaign, particularly Nigel Farage, thought that they'd narrowly lost. But when the Sunderland result came through in the early hours of the morning, then they realised they'd probably won. But what it really did was it tore the country asunder, because there was a lot of people who were passionate sort of Europhiles who felt that we would be better inside the EU. And a lot of people on the other side felt that it was a sort of some form of liberation. But as it turned out, you know, some people ended up having what they called regrets, simply because they eventually, because it took 3 years of politicking and haggling and messing around, that people were just so fed up with it. Mm. You must remember that. I mean, it was, you know, by the time 2019 came around, Boris Johnson was PM, called general election in December, and he won a landslide because he had that slogan, "Get Brexit Done."
Yeah, and I mean, Kent in particular had quite a significant role, I think, in sort of the whole Brexit or Euroscepticism story. I mean, Mark Reckless was elected as UKIP. He defected from the Tories to UKIP in 2014, prior to sort of the referendum being called in that 2015 election. The following year, the referendum was promised as sort of to put UKIP back in that box because of...
Absolutely. There was two reasons why Cameron did it. I mean, he wanted to lay to rest the ghost of the revenant tapping on the window. That was, the whole issue of Europe within the Conservative Party was deeply divisive. He thought, well, if you get that out of the way once and for all, then you get rid of it once and for all. But also, it was to stem that threat from UKIP, because they'd had some really, really good local election results. You know, they had they became the opposition at Kent County Council with not millions of councillors, but they still had quite a few. So he clearly thought that there was some sort of a threat there. Farage being Farage, and he's still around, and he's, you know, he's possibly the prime minister in waiting. And it just goes to show that that was a threat that he sensed, and he felt as if he could take it on, but thought he was going to win. Mm. But people, maybe not because of the campaigns or maybe because of the campaigns, then sort of took a view, well, this is my one chance to have a say.
Yeah.
And they took it.
Dan, what do you remember?
Well, I was only 16 at the time, actually. So I don't remember. I was very political as a teenager. I don't remember the campaign very much, but I definitely remember the result. Because June 23rd, it was a school day. It was not too far from the start of my GCSE exams, I imagine. It was the talk of the class and the talk of the town. And obviously, it was quite a big issue of debate in Dover as well, because Dover was basically instinctively quite what we would now call Brexity, quite UKIP-y. Immigration was a massive issue. I and literally everyone I knew and all my friends had people in our close family who were long-time like UKIP supporters and Eurosceptics. But as a result, a lot of the young people, people I was at school with, basically because a lot of people's parents were Brexiters, some identified quite tribally as being Remain, and they basically thought that old people were voting to screw us over. But strangely enough, it wasn't Dover that delivered the strongest Brexit result in Kent. I think it was Gravesham. And I think part of that is because there was still quite a lot of people, even older people in Dover, who had kind of folk memories of closer ties to Europe, facilitated by the port economy, which used to employ a lot more people than it does. I don't really remember anything of the campaign in Dover. I don't remember seeing politicians around. I remember the result. I remember the famous Banksy graffiti on the side of an abandoned building that was like the EU flag with a star being chiselled out, which popped up not long ago.
Yeah, it was chopped up a ladder and a ghost in the snow.
Yeah, which I think...
no bomb site.
I think it increased the value of that building massively and led to an ownership dispute over it. But no, I only remember the aftermath, and it was only at that point that I really remember talking about it with people a lot. What about you, Rob? Because obviously you weren't in Kent at the time.
No, I wasn't. I was up north. I mean, I don't really remember. I wasn't particularly politically engaged at the time. I was still too young to vote in the referendum actually at the time, so I didn't get my say. But I remember people talking about it, but the people who seemed to talk about it the most didn't seem to have much of a clue, to be honest. seemed to me, but then I didn't have a clue either. So, but the things I really remember, I mean, obviously there were some pretty significant moments. I remember when Joe Cox was obviously killed during the campaign, which is obviously very shocking.
I forget that string.
And you know, obviously the as you say, the bus, and you know, the sort of big moments like that. I also remember the strangest moment, the two sort of kind of that partially passed into, you know, faded from memory, is Bob Geldof's flotilla on the Thames.
Oh yeah,
which was quite. I really remember that and thinking this is just bizarre, and it was very strange. And you know, everyone seemed because it was. I think it was Farage and a bunch of fishermen in one boat.
Yeah, Farage had a little flotilla of boats, and Geldof and Remain chums came by on a slightly different ship. Sorry, it wasn't a ship, it was a boat. And then it all got a bit ugly, and the fishermen then sort of went alongside Geldof's boat, and then it all sort of got a bit shouty,
yes,
and
yeah,
a bit passionate, and eventually they all went home.
Mm. it was just a sort of quite an absurd sort of, oh, what's happening in the Brexit world today? Oh, it's, well, as you say, I didn't call it Brexit world, but what's happening in the campaign today? Oh, Bob Geldof is shouting at a bunch of fishermen on, you know, in the Thames. It was a bit odd. But, and the other thing I remember was I didn't stay up to watch the results or anything like that, but somehow I caught that, I don't know if Gibraltar was one of the first to sort of declare.
Yeah, yeah, and it voted overwhelmingly.
Yeah, and I remember thinking, oh, yes, of course. You know, there are so, I mean, I think lots of people, there are lots of elements which people just didn't consider, you know, whether that be sort of the impact specifically on Dover in Kent or Northern Ireland or, you know, Gibraltar, these lots of different things. And actually a third thing, which is just from record now, is obviously we voted and, you know, the result came out. And then the next day, sort of interviews with people. And I remember a bald man, I can't give you any better description than that, I'm afraid, but he basically said, oh, I didn't think that it would happen. I voted for it because I thought it would lose.
That is very much what was the overwhelming feeling afterwards, was that they didn't see it coming, because they didn't see that people didn't really have a full grasp of the facts most of the time on both sides, not just on the Leave side. But secondly, that they saw it as an opportunity, because they saw some people thought Europe was just a huge sort of, you know, self-serving, politically orientated organization that no longer was what it was set out to be, which was a post-war kind of way of everybody playing nicely together and not meant to be politically sort of like focused, but that's the way it became.
Back in 2016, our colleagues over at KMTV hosted a debate between then South Thanet MP Craig McKinley, who supported the Leave campaign, and then Ashford MP Damien Green, who supported Remain. 10 years later, the two were reunited to discuss how the intervening years had gone and the significance of the vote.
Do you still support leaving the European Union? Was that a right decision at the time?
Absolutely. I mean, I would have done it all over again and fought it with the same vigour than I did then. I just want to make one observation. It's horrible seeing things from 10 years ago, isn't it, Damien?
We were a lot smarter in those days.
We were,
as younger.
Smarter. Damien had hair and I had arms and legs. So, you know, how things change in 10 years. But, no, the same arguments about sovereignty, about being able to do your own thing, about saving that money that we give to the European Union, all of those Brexit freedoms, they're just as important now as they were then.
Those who thought we were going to move into sunlit uplands have palpably been proved wrong. One of my fears at the time is that Britain would be a smaller voice in the world outside the EU. And I'm afraid that is the case, that America and China are now, palpably the world's two biggest superpowers. They deal with each other. Trump wants to deal with Putin for reasons that we don't need to go into here. And Europe is, as a bloc, has some sort of power. But Britain is one of those middle powers. Mark Carney made a very good speech at Davos pointing out that there are a lot of countries like Canada, like Britain, like Australia, that now need to get their act together. And I just fear that Britain's influence in the world is less now than it was previously, because we don't have that amplification of being part of a large body.
Do you think people have changed their views on Brexit? You know, the people who voted for it, people talk about regret, because apparently we've got to shove words together all the time now. But do you think people regret their votes, Simon?
I think there's a lot of people, if they had known how much division and how long it would have taken the British political establishment to actually get some form of a deal, however rubbish it was, in the end, I think people probably would have maybe thought differently, but that's the benefit of hindsight.
Mm. I think, so we had a story in Kent Online this week documenting the anniversary, and has some sort of long-term research where our colleagues went and polled people in Kent on the streets, basically. And they did find that, I think it's something like one in four people who voted Leave say they would now vote Remain. And this kind of polling has given, has much enthused people who voted Remain and sort of hangers on for that cause ever since the referendum in 2016. I think people being asked in the context of a kind of flash poll, what do you think of Brexit? The past 10 years of British politics, people immediately think it's been very chaotic, so many prime ministers, all this kind of thing. Especially for broadly non-political people, many of whom Brexit might be the only thing they've ever voted on, it's pretty unsurprising that a lot of people then say, then kind of trace these problems we've had since 2016 to Brexit. I think they're, in certain ways, they're right to do that. The question is whether you think the chaos it's caused for political parties is a good or a bad thing. But that's not the same thing as saying that if there was ever a rerun of the vote, that it would therefore go the other way. And especially because I remember this was an argument people started saying just after the referendum, which was, the Brexit vote was so dominated by the elderly, give it 5-10 years, they'll all die out, basically, and we'll have... and then there'll be a majority support for Remain, which is obviously a very, very cynical and slightly troubling argument. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. Yet young people tended to vote Remain, older people tended to vote Leave. But I think people's supposed regret of the vote is bound up with other political problems, which are not necessarily to do with Brexit.
I think Brexit was one of the sort of key pivotal moments in the last, since the turn of the new century, where you had the global financial crash, which we are still feeling the effects of today. And then we had the Brexit vote, and then we had COVID, and then we had the political chaos plus the wars. Mm. And people have got other things to worry about, and they probably think, if being in the EU again would make us a bit better off, then they probably think differently. Plus, as you say, Dan, I mean, you've got a lot of young people coming through, probably think being European is not a bad thing, because it ensures you the the freedom to move here and there and go and do things that you want to do, which is obviously something that's not really an option at the minute.
One thing which sort of in the immediate aftermath, well, for quite a while afterwards, I think, was the sort of phrase of, I voted Remain, but, you know, I'm a Democrat and I sort of respect the result of, you know.
Well, that was something that Damien Green was saying in that interview. I mean, he was fairly phlegmatic. That was the thing that Damien Green was saying in that exchange with Craig. He was pretty phlegmatic about it. But he also said, though, there's a lot of talk, and I can't remember, I don't know whether you remember this or not, but not so long afterwards, that, you know, within 6 months, they were talking about a second referendum. Mm. And Damien Green made a very good point that basically if you had a second referendum, the result would probably just be the same, yet all the more emphatic, because people had felt that they had their say. It's difficult to see how many benefits there have actually been, but, you know, Craig McKinley was making the point, well, you know, we're freed up on things like tariffs, for example, which, you know, gives us a little bit of freedom economically. But you set that against the backdrop of the mess that the economy is actually in and how much debt we were actually sort of racking up all the time. It's hard to see where the benefits have come from, but I don't think that's necessarily anything to do with Brexit itself. I think the problems go right back to the global crash. I mean, you know, I remember it well. I mean, I was working in the newspaper industry and just, you know, there was 1 week, a newspaper I was working on would normally have 88 pages and it went down to 48. The advertiser was literally just dropping out one after another. And then suddenly we had to try and find a way back and getting the papers into some sort of like proper shape and profitable again. And it took 18 months. And that was just the rescue mission. Thereafter, it was completely different because there was so much trouble after that event. People had got themselves in so much debt, either with credit cards or mortgages, that thereafter there was a great deal of uncertainty. Jobs were never quite as secure as they once were. And then you lead that up and then you have something like Brexit and you have a party like UKIP that was kind of playing on the fears of people about everything, but blaming it all on Europe. And then suddenly people felt as if they had something to protest about. You move it on till the most recent times. And what you've got now is a party led by Nigel Farage and a party led by somebody like Zach Polanski at the opposite ends of the political spectrum, both, you know, doing really, really well. And that's what's happened. That's what's happened. And I don't think it's necessarily Brexit. I think it was probably before that.
I also want to say, I think you talk about it alongside things like the great financial crash, and I think it is appropriate to talk of it in those kind that level of world historical terms. It was the single biggest electoral mandate ever given to anything in British history. The highest turnout in any vote. Well, I think the only exception, I think in raw vote numbers, I think, strangely enough, John Major in 1992 might have got more, or his Tory party may have got more votes.
But what was the turnout for Brexit? I can't remember.
79?
72? Something like
it was very high. I didn't usually get for
it. Well, it was higher than your average general election.
Yeah. And it was the first time in any country, the public of any country had been given a full referendum on the form of sort of supranational government, which has dominated the world economy since the 1990s and voted against it. You know, there were referendums on such like stuff like the ratification of the Rome Treaty in France in 2005, as I think there was one in Ireland as well. And they were fraught with all kinds of problems. But Brexit was the British public delivering a very clear mandate against an entire system of economic management and political management, and a very clear answer. I think it shouldn't be understated that was genuinely world historic, and it shows that 10 years later we're still talking about it and the influence of it still ripples out.
It was, as we've sort of alluded to, quite a big shock. A lot of people didn't expect it, and something that Lord McKinley and Damien spoke about was the sort of the turmoil in Parliament prior to getting that deal over the line.
It was grim. That the negotiations were difficult, made more difficult by the fact that you know, there was not a majority inside the Conservative Party that would agree on any particular deal for years. And, you know, Craig and I were on, as it were, different sides of this argument, but it showed you can still remain friends, even if you have different views on Europe. But the point is, the Tory party was evidently presenting a disunited face to the public with all the political consequences we've seen, but also the European side of the negotiations could see,
they could see the weakness,
that this was a weak government. And so we ended up spending 3 years trying to get a deal. Yeah, lost a prime minister in the process, had to do an emergency deal at the end of it. And the sort of British politics felt exhausted.
Because the country looked divided, Parliament was, there were groups gathering that were stopping a no-deal Brexit and all sorts of parliamentary shenanigans that I'd never seen before. And the Conservative Party, meant to be in the chair of this, divided as well. So the European Union just picked us off. We were never going to get a great deal, in my view. Even though the deal we got in the end was perfectly adequate, it could have been quicker and better.
So they talked about, so many sort of big events that seemed massive at the time, last minute votes, there was the one day where there were five different options and none of them got through and all that sort of thing.
It's an absolute mess.
Yeah. And it all seemed vitally important at the time. But now a lot of it, I think, is sort of, we don't really think about it anymore. I mean, did British politics go a bit mad for a bit, and have we ever really recovered?
I think it's a testament to how incredibly used to the logic of member statehood that British politicians were. The fact they were given a very clear answer on obviously a very complicated and difficult problem leaving the European Union, but that they had to spend so long arguing of the minutiae of all these different ways of doing it. And it caused huge chaos inside British political parties. It basically doomed the Conservatives. I'd say in the long term, it essentially doomed the Labour Party, and they're basically still dying despite being in office. British politics did go pretty crazy, but I don't think it's easy to look at that kind of chaos and say, oh, this is terrible. Clearly the originating vote was the problem. But I think it exposed that British politicians really didn't know how to respond to an incredibly clear mandate because they were so used to being part of the European Union. Even Brexiters inside the Conservative Party and in the government really, really struggled to deliver on the mandate they were given. And I think that's a testament to how closely wedded they were to EU membership. And I think it's a good thing that British voters were able to indirectly expose that politicians weren't really used to the idea of governing themselves properly and to force them to make incredibly hard choices. Whether it's gone particularly well is a different question. But I think the fact that politicians are objectively more answerable to the voters and citizens and have to justify themselves to voters more as a result of Brexit, I think, is progress by basically any means.
And what I would say is it actually caused terror within the European Union itself, because they felt that, Italy at one point looked as if they might be dropping out. The Netherlands looked like they might be dropping out. France was talking about it. Spain was even rumoured to be talking about it. It was ever on the cards, but they could see the whole superstructure beginning to sort of unravel. If any more came out, it was a big enough shock for one of the founder members of the EU to drop out. So I think that it survived, but there are lots and lots of other pressures on the EU at the minute. A lot of the European economies are really not doing very well, and they sort of mirror the same sort of problems that Britain has. And I think that again probably goes back long before Brexit actually happened. I think there is just a problem with the economies in the Western Hemisphere.
Following, obviously, we've seen sort of turnover of prime ministers, David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, Rishi Sunak. And particularly in the early sort of aftermath, there was a significance to which side of the argument you had been on, whether you had always been a Brexiteer or whether you were a repentant Remainer. Do you think that that's still as significant now? Do you think, obviously Andy Burnham, which we'll talk about slightly later in the show about Andy Burnham's sort of rise to the front, is the fact that he was, pro-EU, is that going to be a big problem for him? Or have we kind of basically Brexit, although it's still very significant, it's not the top thing that people think about when they're choosing who they want to be in charge?
I don't know about you, but I think people are kind of over it. A lot of people who think are quite angry about the fact that we're out and still angry about it. But I think people have got so many other things to worry about. We're out, and therefore, it doesn't affect the price of bread. Their situation at home
and their employment status and the pressure of the cost of living crisis and all the rest of it. That's what impinges on people's lives. And people are thinking, oh, well, you know, I wish we'd stayed in the European Union. I don't think they think that, because I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference.
I think the people who are really loyally, tribally identified as either a Brexiteer or a Remainer, that's really, really on the fringes of British politics. But the, as I said earlier, the consequences of it still ripple out in the Reform UK, widely seen as the challenger party, the unofficial opposition. That, you know, they were called the Brexit Party. They're a party entirely forged in the crucible of Euroscepticism and its victory. So a lot of people, even a lot of people who vote Reform, probably wouldn't, you know, their first political identification when you ask them wouldn't be, I'm a Brexiter, it'd be, I support Nigel Farage, I support Reform, or whatever. So I think it does still matter, but in a very indirect way. And politicians who are too vociferously Remain and make it a big part of their identity 10 years after the fact, I think they'd be punished for it. You know, even in the immediate aftermath, people who were ultra, ultra Remainers who tied their political identity to it, like Joe Swinson, the former leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Yeah, but the following election, they didn't mention Europe at all.
Yeah, exactly. They got battered as a result of it, and like, because Liberal Democrats made themselves the party of the EU, essentially, and that was incredibly unpopular. And well, I think it shows in that a lot of people who are in the Labour Party now, a lot of Labour MPs were Remainers who want to rejoin the European Union at some point. It's very apparent. Won't openly say it because they know it alienates people.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, a roll of the dice, the thinking, well, you know, we'll appeal to the Remainers. But the fact of the matter is they just didn't like the Lib Dem brand at the time. Of course, things have changed and they've kind of they've worked their way back. Mm.
So do we want to go back?
I think if we were to relitigate, as you put it, Damien, the whole argument to the people, once the discussion about, oh yes, if you went back in, you'd be paying 25 billion, if not 30 billion a year in fees, and the requirement of any new members, because we'd be deemed to be a new member again, you would have to have a pathway to joining the euro. As I think, as Damien said, I think the result would be, we've done this once, we're saying the same thing again.
I think, I mean, looking at polling evidence, people have, on the whole, you know, shown a certain amount of remorse. But again, I don't think it's time to have another referendum, because God knows politics is divisive enough at the moment.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
I mean, Damien in this interview, in this debate, said, you know, he didn't feel that, you know, basically we should make the best of Brexit as it is. Do you think that long term, I mean, not in the next five, maybe in the next 50, is there a route back for Britain into the EU, or is it basically, you know?
I don't know. I'd never say never. I mean, there's nothing to stop, you know, in 10 years' time having another referendum. But I mean, I thought we'd made that point very well, that what Britain hasn't done very well is make the best of the benefits that, you know, have come from, because there's so little political will within the political establishment to make it work, because there are so many people within Parliament who are A, obsessed with keeping their own seats, and B, not really wanting to bring it up. And there's no will to make it work. That seems to be what the problem is.
And they're not used to it. Like I said, they are used to, and they were politicised in the era of member statehoods. They're not used to, you know, Britain now has to govern itself in a really tangible, material way, and the political class are completely unsuited to it. That most people in politics now who are over the age of about 50 will have never known Britain outside of the European Union. Like, they are really tangibly sort of cut loose from the political world. They knew it, and they're incapable of responding to it.
I mean, I think there is something in the element of politicians not seeing, basically they see when we were in the EU things worked, so why don't we just go back to the EU? I think that's a certain element of thinking. Somebody who certainly does not have that element of thinking is Nigel Farage, leader of Reform UK.
That's the point I was making earlier, Rob, is the fact that things were broken before Brexit. Things weren't working very well back then either.
I know. But what I'm basically trying to get to is Nigel Farage's argument is the current crop of Keir Starmer and soon to be Andy Burnham, but the Conservative Party as well, the Lib Dems, probably the Greens, they're not capable of making Brexit a success, and he is. Do you think he is right on that? Is he the one man who can make get us to those sunlit uplands that we promised?
No, I don't. I don't think anybody can at the minute. The country is in such a mess and is in need of such fundamental reform on many, many levels. It's difficult to see that one guy. But Burnham's in real trouble, I think, in some ways, because he's going to have some real tangible results within 6 months, you know, maybe a year, and then people will turn on him.
Yeah.
So anyway, but we'll come back to that.
I think if there was ever to be an attempt to rejoin the EU openly in the next, probably at least 20, 30 years, it would be absolutely poisonous. Whether it comes as a manifesto commitment of a party or through the form of another referendum, it would be, I think, really, really divisive. It would probably be much, much more acrimonious than the first time round. It would reopen divisions, which, as we say, a lot of people have now, especially out there in the real world outside of politics, have basically accustomed themselves to, even if they were Remainers. And also the fact that, you know, the EU frankly would never allow it. They already did what they could to exact a very high price from Britain upon leaving, to show what happens to countries who leave it. And there's no way we'd ever be able to rejoin on the same terms that we had. And you know, all these fantasies of, oh, maybe we can have a relationship to them like Norway does or something like that. It's never going to happen. The EU, I don't see why they would want it. I just think it would be politically very dangerous for anyone who proposes it. But this is shown in the fact that Labour politicians more or less openly say that the solution then is just to kind of realign ourselves with the EU by stealth. Tony Vaughan said as much to me when I interviewed him on the podcast last month, where he said, we don't want to reopen those divisions, but we should align ourselves to the EU and all kinds of things. There's this dynamic alignment bill, which is currently going through Parliament, which sounds very technical, but essentially means that we will, of our own free will, choose to align ourselves with EU standards on which we have no say. And that is the move of a political class, which is overwhelmingly pro-Remain now. It's to continue aligning us with the EU, essentially indirectly, because anything as open as another referendum or a commitment to rejoin would be radioactive.
Yeah, but just leaving doesn't mean to say you can't be friends with the European Union. It's you just have to form a different relationship. But I think that the whole shock of not, the whole shock of leaving has such a profound effect on the country and on our political establishment that they couldn't see anything other than this just being a complete disaster, as opposed to saying, okay, right, well, this is what we've got. Let's try and make the best of it. And that's kind of what Damian Green was saying in that interview, and I thought that was really interesting.
You can watch the full debate between Lord McKinley and Damian Green at kentonline.co.uk/KMTV. Now, finally, it will be remiss of us not to talk about probably the biggest news this week, if not of the year, and that is Prime Minister Keir Starmer's announcement he'd be resigning once the Labour Party had selected a successor, generally predicted to be Andy Burnham, the former Mayor of Greater Manchester, now MP of Makerfield. So, what are your thoughts on this? Dan, should we come to you first?
I think it's not... Well, I'm surprised it happened, basically, because I was taken and trusting by reporting in places like New Statesman in particular for the past several months that have said that Keir Starmer would basically hang on and fight any contest. I mean, he said himself, I think, on Friday after the Makerfield by-election that he would stay and fight any leadership election. Obviously over the weekend he was convinced otherwise, and that that an open contest between him and anyone else presumably Burnham would be so acrimonious as to sabotage any chance of the Labour Party being successful. So I'm surprised it happened so soon. I kind of thought it was going to happen at some point, and it looks like Andy Burnham's probably not going even going to face a challenger. So it was basically going to be a coronation, which is kind of what everybody expected. But I'm of the opinion the political fortunes of the Labour Party are much, much bigger than the personal unpopularity of Keir Starmer. And I would be very surprised if Andy Burnham was able to turn things round for them in any material way.
Yeah, I kind of agree with Dan. I think that he's got an impossible task ahead of him. It's really interesting, actually. There was a bit of polling came out from More in Common. Luke Trill was posting on this yesterday that hypothetically, as of yesterday, If Andy Burnham was the Prime Minister and there was a general election, who would get the most votes? Well, Reform would slip quite significantly to 191 seats. The Labour Party would get 216. The Conservatives would stay around about 109. The Green Party would get 10. SNP would get 42. And Plaid Cymru would be 12. Now, that is a massively fractured political situation as far as British politics is concerned. And it would only take a Labour, Lib Dem, Green Party, SNP, and Plaid coalition, which is a true rainbow, in order to get just enough votes to have a majority. And the Conservatives and Reform, if they clubbed together and got together with the Ulster Unionists, the DUP, and the traditional unionist voice from across the water, would still be falling short by about 20-odd. So it's a really interesting thing. That kind of polling is not going to make Burnham think about going for a general election early. But if he gets a personal bounce and people are voting for Andy, then perhaps they think they might be able to win it. He's got a problem because if it's a coronation, that he does lack a bit of legitimacy, a bit of validity, and he hasn't got that. So he's got a problem.
Mm. Rob, you used to live in his fiefdom in Manchester for some time, did you not? Do you think, as his management of the buses showing you, he's got what it takes to right ship?
Well, I mean, I think he is incredibly popular and I think very well regarded. His tenure as mayor was quite successful. I think there are a number of initiatives that sort of particularly around homelessness is one, not cracking down on drug use, but helping people to sort of with their addictions was another one, which was very successful.
You had to get to the source of the problem.
So I think he is very well regarded. And I think the result in the Makefield by-election shows he got 54% of the vote. No one else came close. So I think he has a major problem for Keir Starmer is a lack of charisma. I think that is, we shouldn't underestimate that element within British politics, because every problem that comes along, if you can't sort of spin it, for lack of a better word, or sort of put a better face on it, it makes it worse. So I totally agree that Andy Burnham will not face, you know, will not be immediately easy, you know, yellow brick road and, you know, all that sort of thing. I think he will face challenges, but the fact that he will be a bit more friendlier face and sort of, you know, be a bit more charismatic will certainly help him. Whether that's enough, I don't know. To be fair to Keir Starmer, a lot of challenges that he has faced sort of came out of nowhere. You know, the Iran war, for example, was not something that we could see coming, but has had a massive effect on sort of the cost of living, the petrol prices and that sort of thing.
On the flip side, I mean, Andy Burnham's got a lot going for him. He's clearly very bright, went to Cambridge. You know, he's quite down to earth. He loves his football and stuff like that. And he, you know, and clearly loves the area he comes from. But again, he was fairly well regarded when he was serving in the cabinet under the Liberal government before. But he's been away for a long time. And just because you're a good mayor of a one region doesn't mean to say that you can translate it into a national picture. And don't forget, he's in there not at the behest of the British people, but the Parliamentary Labour Party. That's what he's there for. That's the only reason why he's there. So he's got a tough ask because he's going to face all the same problems as Keir Starmer has. The trouble with Starmer, and this is what he's got to avoid, Burnham, is that the flip-flopping, the U-turns, you know, on the winter fuel allowance, the family farm tax, etc. It's just, you know, people just see that as weakness. But equally, there was so much noise around those issues that he felt as if he couldn't do anything about it. What Burnham, I suppose, will have to do in the early few days or few weeks of his premiership, should he become Prime Minister, is tell his backbenchers, look, we're going to have to make some really, really uncomfortable, unpopular decisions over welfare, defence spending, or whatever it happens to be, and say, you guys have got to suck it up. And if you don't suck it up, I'll call a general election and you'll probably lose most of your seats.
Yeah. I think I also read some of the reporting that you were talking about, Dan, about, you know, how Keir Starmer was going to fight on and face a leadership challenge. But I think the backbenchers, those MPs, it became clear, and the reason why he resigned was because it became clear that if Andy Burnham was now going to get the support of all of them, so if there was a challenge, he was never going to win. What were the Kent MPs saying to us this week?
Quite a few Kent MPs
that I speak to were increasingly vocal in their criticism of Starmer over the recent months. Like Tony Vaughan, who we spoke to on the podcast last month, he's been a long-standing critic. Polly Billington, who I believe is the deputy East End MP, she's deputy chair of the Parliamentary Labour Party. So she obviously dealt quite closely with the Prime Minister in the kind of party political sense. She was very critical of him. One thing that I find very interesting is Rosie Duffield, the MP for Canterbury, late of the Labour Party, who left in 2024, only a few months after the election. She told me not long ago that she would even be interested in rejoining the Labour Party under Annie Burnham's leadership.
I'm sure she would.
Well, I mean, I think if she asks to do it, she probably would get let back in. I mean, the party has a right to make political decisions about who's allowed in and out, but I think to refuse someone like that would just cause more of an argument that it's worth. I don't know if she has any particular relationship with Andy Burnham personally, but she certainly didn't have a great one with Keir Starmer. So I imagine, you know, we might even see her rejoin. The only Labour MP in Kent who I can think of who's an extremely loyal supporter of Keir Starmer was Mike Tapp. He was saying the day before Keir Starmer resigned on social media that if the Prime Minister is replaced, there should be a general election, which is brands himself as a patriot. That's not very not very British constitutional of you. That's not how it works here. It's not a presidential system. The change of Prime Minister technically isn't that relevant. But he has been a very loyal supporter of Starmer. He is the traditional Labour Party comes from. He used to work for John Speller, MP for Worley in the Black Country, who's been fighting a war against Trotskyists since the 1970s. So Mike Tapp comes from the people in the Labour Party who like to think of themselves as the old right, the kind of trade unionist right. And he's been a very loyal supporter of Starmer, and I imagine he is soon going to find himself bereft of his ministerial position for the rest of the Parliament. But other than him, I think every Labour MP in Kent has to varying extents been very increasingly open with their criticism of Starmer, and they're all probably quite happy with Burnham taking over.
And they're doing that for a reason, obviously. But the fact of the matter is the polling, the last polling that I've seen, which is, you know, by electoral calculus, which is, you know, they crunch all the numbers from everywhere. Basically, every Labour MP will lose his and her seats. Reform will win the vast majority of them. The Tories will claw back a couple, a few. And the Lib Dems will retain one. So it'd be interesting to see when Andy is the PM, whether there's a bounce in the polls locally. But, you know, that will depend on how he conducts himself in the first, you know, days and weeks of his premiership.
And then, I mean, we've talked about this, Simon, what happens next? Do you think, you know, if there is a coronation, is there a necessity to go for a general election, or is there an attraction for going for an early general election?
I think if he gets reasonably good polling, and the Moore and Common poll I just mentioned is a hypothetical poll, so you can't. It was just an interesting sort of side to have a look at, just to see how it might. But that may well be the way it turns out, and he's not going to go for a general election then. But that makes him very, very weak. Or he could take a view, look, we're going to lose badly, or maybe not as badly as we thought. Let's take the hit now, go back into opposition for a parliament or two, and then rebuild. Because the problem with the Starmer project is becoming apparent, is that they were good at winning the election, but they didn't appear to have a plan, which wasn't something you could accuse Tony Blair of.
Yeah, and reports are suggesting that Andy Burnham is sort of facing a similar problem, in the sense of he's got to come up with a plan of what he's going to do as Prime Minister.
But he's got the manifesto. I mean, he didn't run a general election campaign. He's going to come in and he's going to inherit somebody else's manifesto, which he may or may not agree with.
Well,
and
this is the whole point of the British Constitution, is that Keir Starmer was not elected as President of the UK. He was just so happens to be the Prime Minister is the person who can just
he's leader of the party
happens to be able to lead the party, which has the largest mandate. Thin as their mandate may be, as far as, you know, that is the strongest mandate for an actual government in British politics. A change of leadership technically just means it's a different person who's entrusted to deliver that. That's how it works. But I don't think Andy Burnham will call an election, because it would be basically suicidal. I actually know a few people in the Labour Party who think he should call an election to get a mandate for tax rises and significantly more radical policy, which I suppose I respect the ambition of it, but I don't think anyone in
I don't think anyone in senior Labour politics would agree to that. And as of, I think, reforms made by the last Tory government, you don't need a parliamentary vote anymore to call a snap general election. It's at the personal discretion of the Prime Minister. And I think Andy Burnham, by getting where he is, clearly has enough political nous to realise that calling a general election would be probably the gamble of a century, and I don't think he would win.
No, he wouldn't win. Of course he wouldn't win. But, you know, he can use that as a threat to the backbenchers who might feel the need to, you know, rebel in the same way. They will come to heel. I'm sure of that. Yeah. And if there was a general election to be called, what he would do, he would get rid of all the people who might be troublemakers and find some people who would be a bit more malleable. But, you know, Dan, where do you see an Andy Burnham premiership looking like in 2029?
I think that what will happen.
It's an impossible question, I'm sorry.
I think what we have for the next 3-4 years will be the same as what we have now, but more so. The government, you know, whichever way you cut it, the government and the Labour Party objectively has very, very little support. Less than about 1 in 5 British adults actively voted for the incumbent government. The Labour Party has stopped releasing its membership figures. That's the main reason I'm unhappy that there won't be a leadership election, because I want an accurate count of Labour membership, because they've stopped releasing the numbers because it's collapsed so dramatically in the past 5 years. The Labour Party is they're not special in this. Most British parties like this, but the Labour Party is a completely hollow party now. It doesn't really have that much actual support in the country. Keir Starmer has, even if Andy Burnham has an incredible policy manifesto which will revolutionise the British economy and that kind of thing, parties are the way democracies are governed, and the Labour Party is what is in trouble. Yeah. So I think it would take a miracle for them to survive to the 2029 general election.
I just remember before the 2024 election, and I was quite friendly with a fairly senior Labour Party official, and I kept saying to him, "It looks like you're going to win," and he sort of said, yeah, well, we're taking nothing for granted. We're going to fight for every vote, all the usual nonsense. But when they won, he was very guarded. Even with this massive 170 majority, he was very guarded. It's almost as to say, you know, we've won, now the real problems start. And it's almost he knew, and this is for the benefit of hindsight, given the conversations that we had, but we talked about this on more than one occasion, that basically we're in power, and now this is where the trouble really starts, because, you know, there is so much that needs to be done. We've got a very thin policy agenda to follow, and we don't really have much clue about how to run a government because so few of them had any experience. And so, you know, it was almost like, looking back on it, it was almost like he could foresee the problems ahead and didn't want to seem triumphant or triumphalist. He just thought, well, it's just a continuation of the Ming Vase.
Yeah, which I think is a sort of a significant benefit, as I was saying earlier, for Andy Burnham, is I think Keir Starmer, from things I'd read, was not particularly good at going out and meeting his own MPs and sort of
he was terrible
winning them over.
Yeah, Damien Green said to me, not long after he got elected, it was 100 days of the Labour government, he sort of said, you know, what I'm hearing from my former colleagues at Westminster is basically, you're down in the lobby, he doesn't come in amongst them and squeeze a few elbows and tap them on the shoulder and say, is everything all right? Are the kids okay? Or whatever, the stuff that most PMs do. He just didn't do it at all.
Yeah.
And he was distant.
And so from the sort of conversations that I've sort of had and have read that you two have had as well, the sense I'm getting from MPs, Labour MPs who backed getting rid of Starmer, and, you know, although they're saying, oh, we're really grateful for everything he'd done, they like Andy Burnham better. They've bought into his sort of, if you want to call it persona, if you're that cynical, but, you know, they like him as a person. They like his sort of his social media presence. The fact he's, as you say, he's into his football. He's a bit more sort of, he's got a bit of more of a personality about him. I thought it was quite telling. One of the people I spoke to who will remain nameless, when I was talking about sort of what will Andy Burnham bring to this role, they said, the thing about Andy Burnham is he's very pop, and then they stopped themselves and said he's a great communicator. And I think basically what they wanted to say was he's very popular, and that's what we want. So I think Andy Burnham will bring, or hope probably will hope he can bring to Parliament to win over those backbench MPs, so he can reduce rebellions. Because I think we've talked before about it's almost they're a victim of their own success with that massive majority. That there's more people can go, well, we've got such a big majority, I can rebel a bit more. Whereas, and if they like Andy Burnham, they're like, oh, well, I don't want to rebel against my mate Andy.
If Andy Burnham then sort of says, look, guys, you know, in those sort of maybe sort of slightly more deprived areas, and sort of say, well, look, you know, we have got to get this welfare, but you know, build on. We've got to get people back into work. People are sitting at home on PIPs or whatever, and perhaps maybe shouldn't be, and try and sort of reduce immigration in a sort of sensible way, stopping the boats, which hasn't happened. All the things that there are a million things that could trip him up, but if they've got any chance of surviving, then they've got to basically back him.
Yeah.
Because they can't change him.
That's all from us this week. Don't forget to keep up to date with the latest politics news at Kent Online. Just head to the homepage and hit the politics tab. You can also sign up for our newsletter at kentonline.co.uk/newsletters, where you'll get even more. And don't forget to tune in to KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.